You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sean Leonardo. Sean, thanks so much for being with me today.
My real pleasure to be here.
Sean, we're talking about your show, The Invisible Man, at Christine Tierney. And of course, the title is drawn from the book with the same name, right? So we're talking about, in some ways, I mean, this is encompassing really a retrospective, right? This is work from, I believe, 2007 to this year. It's using that title, The Invisible Man, as a retrospective look on your work and the themes that run through it.
That's correct, and it is a 20-year survey, and I will say that that book by Ralph Ellison is the through line in everything that I've ever produced. And there's a few sort of palpable or really tangible ways to talk about its influence. There are works that are directly in reference to specific lines or chapters of that book, but I think more philosophically and or conceptually, much of my work stems from this place of exploring the experience of invisibility as a person of color in this country. And this notion that due to stereotype, there is a version that precedes us in every room of subjective understanding or perception of us that we have to continuously compete against. And in the book, what is visualized through text is this idea of being so hyper visible when walking any social space, in particular spaces that are dominant by white citizens. In that experience, this idea of double consciousness, that you are conscious that what they are seeing is a version of yourself that is diminished, limited, and therefore, in many cases, belittling. And so you are so invisible to their eyes, or rather hyper-visible in their eyes due to this perception of who you are, that you are rendered invisible.
Right, that's also echoed in Citizen, isn't it? That's the Claudia Rankine
book. That's right.
Book.
Yeah, Claudia Rankine, yes, who another highly influential book to my practice.
Yeah, because she talks about invisibility. I mean, in a course in a whole different style prose. It's nonfiction, but talks about that and also a very kind of literal invisibility. I remember one line from that where she's at a counter and. And someone bumps into her, and they said, "Oh, so sorry, I didn't see you. I really didn't see you." And you know, it's so kind of powerful because we're not talking about a metaphor here. We're talking about literal invisibility that simply hadn't been seen at all. Which is, you know, I mean, as a white male, still that's quite shocking for to read.
And those two things go hand in hand. I think it's quite literally the ways in which you are physically made to be invisible in space, in your interactions, in the ways in which exchanges occur. And then there's this conceptual understanding of invisibility in which how people wish to understand them is a reflection of their own self, their own desires, their own fears, an emphasis on fear, their own ways of moving through the world in which, as a person of color, you must be less than.
Yeah, this is it's a powerful subject. And, you know, if I can mention another one of Claudia Rankine's books, White Card was a powerful book because it talked about the idea of what it means for white collectors to be collecting work by by, you know, African Americans, because what are they actually collecting? You know, it was, you know, there's a, I don't know if you read that book, but there's a heated discussion at a table where one artist, African American artist, doesn't really want her work collected by these people who seem to be incredibly well-meaning, saying all the right things, yet nevertheless they're collecting work about that have been made by Black Americans, African Americans, that are often about trauma. So they're literally kind of collecting traumas, and it seemed, you know, vile the way she talks about it. So how do you feel? I mean, we're just getting into the show. I want to talk about the pieces, but
sure.
How do you feel about that in terms of the relationship with collectors for your work, in terms of what they're collecting and how they're collecting it?
Yeah, that's interesting, because also, you know, I'll be transparent in that this is the first gallery exhibition that I've had in nearly 15 years, primarily for, well, I shouldn't say primarily, but I would say certainly in reaction or relation to what you've just offered. Much of my work, therefore, has been supported by and exhibited by museums, by institutions, because I have always felt, and I've been fortunate that that has been the case, I have always felt that fundamentally an institution's objective and job for the artist is the interpretation of one's work, and therefore the ways in which it is extended through education, through written material, and therefore shared from its conceptual basis. Whereas gallery has a very different agenda of commodifying and selling. Now, I think I'm in a privileged seat in which my relationship with Kristen Tierney feels very different. And the reason that we've arrived at this show is very much to narrativize the last 20 years of my career and really kind of illustrate certain through lines that are important to the practice and therefore important to me. And so, yes, of course, things are for sale. But what is most important to me are the ways in which their works that date back, as you said, to post-grad school are in dialogue with newer works, and therefore the questions that are posed in relation to not only the experience of invisibility, but in that also the ways in which male archetypes and stereotypes, which is a central question of my practice, how do we learn to be men? That these questions are raised anew and given a new light, specifically in the sociopolitical context of 2026.
So let's jump into some of the works. Self-Portrait Icon, sculpture, and this is from 2007.
Sure, wow.
Yeah, let's talk about that one, because this is one of the earliest works in the show, if not the earliest, and it's a self-portrait of a man, looks like a wrestler, but he's got a club in his hand too, a kind of combination self-hero something. Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about this?
I mean, yeah, 2007. Thank you for bringing up the date. That would, you know, so that would have been right after grad school. And much of my work at that time stemmed from self-portrait, and to a certain extent, while it's more buried, all of the work stems from a place of self-portrait, or any more specifically this idea of asking myself the uncomfortable questions as a way to analyze racial stereotype and masculine archetypes, or hyper-masculine archetypes. And I offer that word hyper-masculine because so much of that earlier work revolved around the kind of pop cultural icons and hero figures that I think as a child of immigrant parents taught me not only about American culture, but also about American manhood. And so I would look to figures like Hulk Hogan, Conan, other cartoons, religious figures, military figures that informed me, oh, like what this is what it means to define masculinity in this country. And so that, you know, very strange, maybe the strangest figure in the entire show is a marble hybridized hero type figure that combines, as you said, a wrestler with Tarzan, with, you know, other, you know, strange hero ideals. And I think that's really the most important piece of this, is that I started to present these hybridized heroes in states of failure or in very quiet poses, not to present a sort of alternative archetype, but instead to present the ways in which I've internalized these heroes and therefore feel that I and other young men growing up in this particular era have always been set up for failure. Because to chase this ideal of masculinity or hyper-masculinity, one in which strength and fortitude are prioritized over vulnerability and feeling, really doesn't allow for a fuller self.
Right, and I get that. I get that as much as I can. And let's talk about so how that evolved. Right, there was that self-portrait
yeah.
from 2007, and there's one from 2008, which is quite a bit different. Superhero 4, Sleeping Giant. Yeah, tell me about that one. That's now quite a different way of doing a self-portrait, different medium. Position that's not nearly as heroic. It looks sort of like a collapsed
that's right.
boxer or wrestler laying on the ground.
Yeah, I think the work during that time started increasingly pictorializing these states of failure, and this being the ultimate collapse. There's another very similar around that timeline, a self-portrait, Fall 2, in which there's this giant, a hulking figure rising, or it's sort of blurry whether the figure is rising or descending in a state of collapse or defeat. And again, these heroes started to appear in very specific kind of form in the ways in which I would pull from different hero archetypes into this hybridized figure. That was me, as a way to explore the question of if one cannot perform heroism, or if a hero has no one to save, what is their purpose? What is their meaning? How would you then start to identify yourself as a hero? And that leading to this complete, not only physical, but social, emotional, psychic collapse. And that dominated a lot of the work then.
And moving further ahead, there's Champ. This is Mike Tyson. We're in 2014 now.
That's right. Yeah, the work started to, around that time, importantly, extend outside of myself and really analyzing these heroes that have been canonized as the greatest of all time. And Mike Tyson is a figure that I return to over and over again because he was quite literally bred to be a champion from the age of 16. And told by the age of 17 that he was going to be the champion of the world. And if you just hear, no one ever really critically looks at or analyzes the term, right? Champion of the world at the age of 17. And then in accompaniment of that, also told that he was a brute, told that he was an animal, told that he was unstoppable. And I try to think about what that might do to someone's psyche in the development of hero. These words, these ways in which we inform our sense of self, also speak to societal's own ambitions, fears, sense of defeat, all these ways in which we uphold a person like Mike Tyson because it serves us a purpose. We need to have this type of individual chase and embody greatness. But as a black man who's also subhuman, we wait for the moment to tear him down when the opportunity arises. So that drawing is specifically of Tyson post-match at the very end of his career, where it's so evident that his body, his psyche, his mind is beaten and battered.
Yeah. And there's so many we could talk about here, but I want to move forward to the latest work, which seems to be a nice pairing with that. I mean, these all go so well together,
sure.
But we went undefeated. And of course, this is a multi-channel video and a single-channel video, rather. We went undefeated. Tell me a little bit about this one, because now we're jumping another 10 years ahead, more actually 12 years ahead, to a similar a similar subject, right? Dealt with in a very different way, and of course it's video as well.
Yeah, there's some strange returns happening in my practice that are illuminated through this show. And, you know, to be very honest, I haven't gathered all the language around what is occurring in terms of not, this, I wouldn't call it nostalgia, but this remembrance or way of looking back in order to find meaning and resonance today and in the future. And so I had a huge body of work in 2008, 2009, 2010, exploring my 10-year career as a football player. I started at the age of 11 through college. And much of my work moves from that dual experience of being both athlete and artist. But when I really started to critically examine my participation in football is when some of the richest, I think, most personal work started to appear. And because it was football, it was also a time in which I started to extend outward and incorporate other, in literally, players into my work, whether that be football players, mixed martial artists, wrestlers, et cetera, et cetera. And that brings us to today, in which last year was the 30th anniversary of a very particular season that shaped who I am. In 1995, playing in the boroughs for a team named the Queens Falcons, in which we would travel throughout New York City competing against other borough teams. And this particular multiracial team, the only multiracial team in the entire league, found a way against all odds to not only win the championship, but go undefeated. And there's an earlier project that we explored our understandings of ways in which that bestowed pride in us. And then I returned to those same players 30 years later, as you said, to do the opposite and really explore how we've internalized and therefore understand and express failure. And so what you see in the video is somewhat of a technological trick in which I've asked them to return to a single play that could have cost them their position or cost the game and therefore cost us the record of going undefeated. Every single player had a very specific play in mind, which tells you something, how easy it is to remember the failures over the wins. And by re-embodying the memory of that play physically and emotionally, also, therefore, recalling what it taught us. All four of those individuals, including myself in the video, are fathers. And so trying to really explore as men that were upheld as young men by winning a championship in this league, how do we also learn to get out of our own way and be good fathers, good friends, good husbands? What did the experience of failure teach us about being a man?
Well, that's so powerful. I would imagine the conversation that you had as you produced this and brought them together and had these, these scenes reenacted or created, that the conversation you had with them, I mean, this is a very personal subject, right? How to be a
very
be a
personal.
Good, be a
there
good
was a
dad.
Lot of there was a lot of hesitation, and mm-hmm. I think the thing that I failed to mention in terms of this technological trick is that I've asked them to incrementally slow down their movements so that the physical embodiment would take, after a certain amount of time, backseat to the emotional remembering and ways of internalizing that memory. And then the camera also filmed in slow motion. So what you're seeing in the video is this production of incredibly slowed down image to the extent that at certain points you think it's a still image. But what is happening is that they have, including myself, have slowed it down, and then along with the camera slowing it down even further, to a place in which what is dominant in the action is not the physical movement itself, but instead the ways in which you can see us all remembering.
Yeah, I so love that. What a great project on so many levels. Of course, for listeners, go see the show because these are works that have to be seen, of course, up till August 7th, I want to of this year, 2026. I want to ask you one more question before we go a little off topic. What are you reading at the moment?
Oh, man. So I'm in the middle of a well-lauded book by Ocean Vuong, hope I'm saying that correctly, entitled On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. And it's a love letter to both his mother, but I think to also a younger former self. And he's exploring the complexity of growing up in and with, surrounded by trauma. And the dislocation that that creates, and the distance that creates between family members, but also in the ways that you remember and later become an adult. And it's incredibly beautiful. That language is so eloquent, but it's also in the embodiment of memory. His use of language is excruciating.
Yeah, so glad you mentioned that. It's a gorgeous book. Again, Sean, I want to thank you for talking with me today. Again, encourage listeners to go and see the show. There's more here to explore, of course, online, but has to be seen. Sean, thank you so much for your time and talking with me today.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share these words.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.